Okay, we got a correction here. Last week from Jake Sexton, I'd gotten this story that the head of Homeland Security was able to get to the powers of God by being able to change laws at will and to have no judicial review. Well, thankfully, somebody saw sense and said that the judicial review would be a necessity. A necessity. So, a correction. All right. Meanwhile, there still is no investigation whatsoever of the misconduct at Abu Ghraib. It's the old theme back again. Still trying to figure out how we can have a real revolution. How we can really change things. And so today we're going to look up in the sky and look at the stars and at Hubble Telescope. And I've got a brief interview with Paul Krupp, the head of the Griffith Observatory. It's from Mr. KABC because this is the Thursday Impressionistic News. But I also have an interview with Rush Riddle, who is as a philanthropist. He's a guy who makes decent money. And he shares it with all that he can, with all that he can, you know? And that's kind of what it's about. Also, today we have some stuff on filibusters, maybe a little bit on the Koran. We have the weekly news and review, and I got to fit some music in there sometime. Yes, it's time. It is May. It's May 19th, 2005. This is killradio.org. Blasting at you from Los Angeles to all of you out there in the world. So press your ears against the speakers. It's time once again for the Impressionistic News.
Talked about this before. We've advanced more in the last 50 years than in the past 2,000 years.
Oh yeah, incredibly. In fact, I think the compression of technological innovation is even more striking than that. And it's an accelerating compression. I mean, each interval of time that you take, and you start looking, well, what happened a year ago compared to now? And the technological innovation just in information processing in computers.
Am I right about this? That 2 years ago we didn't actually have evidence of extrasolar planets?
It's a little bit longer than that, but not much. The very first extrasolar planets around other stars, were actually discovered a few years before that. But that first discovery showed that the first ones were kind of weird, and then it accelerated, and these numbers started multiplying fast. That is, the techniques that were being pioneered were proved to work, and then, of course, it's like a harvest of these things. So we're well over 100, 130 of them now.
Welcome to KABC. You're on with Dr. Krupp from the
Yep, it's Dr. Krupp from the Griffith Observatory on Mr. KABC the other night, and he'll be back for a little bit more. The United States was investigating claims that someone flushed a copy of the Koran down a Guantanamo Bay toilet. In Afghanistan, news of the flushing led to riots where hundreds chanted "Death to America," and at least 15 people died. Of course, I should tell you that it turns out that those riots probably had nothing to do with Newsweek. Newsweek, which published the original report of the Koran desecration, retracted the story but pointed out that similar behavior has been widely reported. This is the weekly news and review presented by killradio.org, and this was originally posted May 17th on the harpers.org website by Paul Ford. This concerns the news of the past week. Connecticut held its first execution in 45 years, and a Holocaust memorial opened in Berlin. Some people were upset that it only commemorated the deaths of Jews. The White House and the Capitol building were evacuated for a few minutes when a small Cessna airplane got lost and strayed into restricted airspace. And Tom DeLay admitted that when he was head of the Department of Homeland Insecurity, he let other administration officials bully him into raising the terrorist attack threat level based on only flimsy evidence. It was uncertain whether Boston could host a convention for minority journalists in 2008, because the city has a law requiring that all Native Americans who enter the city be arrested. Pope Benedict the 16th called for Pope John Paul II to be beatified. Investigators are now looking for a miracle. Burma claimed that a world-famous organization of a certain superpower nation had trained the rebels who recently bombed shopping centers in Rangoon. The organization is apparently based in Washington, D.C. Zapatista spokesman Subcomandante Marcos challenged Italy's Inter Milan soccer team to a match against a team of Zapatista soldiers. And Mexican President Vicente Fox called on the United States to reconsider its immigration policies. There is no doubt, he said, that Mexicans, filled with dignity, willingness, and ability to work, are doing jobs that not even blacks want to do there in the United States. The state economy and culture senator of Bremen, Germany, resigned under criticism for pouring wine on a homeless man's head. And Charlotte Spadaro, the former mayor of Beverly Hills, California, was in trouble for keeping 135 dogs and 30 cats in her home, and for filling a rental van with a ton of dead animals and leaving it out on the street. This was the mayor? I didn't hear this story. Another earthquake struck Sumatra, and more than 100 people died when a ferry sank off the shores of southern Bangladesh. Condoleezza Rice visited Iraq, where things are not getting better. Iraq is emerging from a long national nightmare of tyranny, she said, not indicating whose tyranny she meant. 11 corpses, 4 beheaded, were found south of Baghdad in Iskenderiya. 10 soldiers were found dead in Ramadi, and at least 71 people died in suicide bombings in Tikrit, Hawija, and Baghdad. The Senate approved $82 billion in emergency funding for the war. And, of course, this won't be part of the national budget, and passed legislation supporting a standardized national driver's license. A national driver's license. There was unrest in Uzbekistan. Mali sentenced 11 men to jail for refusing to let their children be vaccinated for polio. In Nigeria, several states have banned the vaccine because they believe it will make their daughters sterile. The polio outbreak in Yemen was getting worse, as was the mumps epidemic in the UK. British doctors implanted 5 devices into a stroke victim's unusable arm to help it work again, and a study found that women who abuse alcohol are more likely to suffer brain damage than men. Children in the Western world were hitting puberty earlier, often at age 7. Researchers suggested that this was done due to indifferent fathers, childhood obesity, exposure to pesticides, or watching too much television. That makes you go to puberty earlier. It was revealed that Michael Jackson used chimpanzees to dust his house, clean his windows, and brush his toilets. The U.S. Army decided to allow soldiers to enlist for only 15 months of active duty, followed by 2 years of service in the National Guard or Army Reserve so that they can be sent back to Iraq. In Brazil, a man and his parents were murdered when the man lost a real-life role-playing murder game. Israel and Lebanon shelled each other, and researchers in Japan developed a fuel cell that runs on blood. The grand opening of a new post office at a United States air base in South Korea was postponed, and a nearby shopping mall evacuated when a mail scanning device mistook a package of sauerkraut for a dangerous chemical. Australian researchers were working to clone the extinct Tasmanian tiger, and researchers in Tokyo used smoothed particle hydrodynamics to prove that stones skip farthest when they strike the surface of water at a 20-degree angle. Walmart apologized for running an advertisement that equated current Arizona zoning ordinances with the Nazi regime. Using a photo of a 1933 book burning in Berlin, the ad read, "Should we let government tell us what we can read? Of course not. So why should we allow local government to limit where we shop?" I can answer that. Scientists found that sexually well-endowed fish are slower swimmers and thus more likely to be eaten. But girlfish find them attractive even so. And three Michigan judges decided that a cable show featuring a man's joke-telling penis was more about indecent exposure than free speech. Researchers at Cornell University developed a robot that can build copies of itself from spare parts. And British archaeologists dug up a 2,000-year-old shoe. It was either a size 9 or 10, they said. Two tiger cubs died in Burma despite being breastfed by a woman. The cubs will be stuffed. The governor of Idaho was bouncing checks. A man was suing a hospital in Orlando, Florida for injecting him with green and red sparkling glitter instead of Demerol. Whew. And in Utah, a high school teacher brought his class to see the dissection of a live dog. I thought he said that it would be just a really good experience. Yes. So that's the posted weekly news for the last week. This is Bennett, your faithless host for Kill Radio, saying thanks for listening. This is Voice Dude. Eleanor of Mandalay by Voice Dude. You got what that was, right? Okay, so even on the Impressionistic News a couple weeks ago, I had a couple of, or actually four senators on talking about filibusters. When I think of the word filibuster, I think of Jimmy Stewart in Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, that little fairy tale that Frank Capra made back in the 30s, that for some reason I still meet people who think that it's realistic. It's a bloody cartoon. But at one point, Jimmy Stewart's Mr. Smith, Jefferson Smith he's called, he decides that he's going to have to filibuster in order to prevent them from taking a vote on a measure that he doesn't want them to vote on. And so he pulls out a paper bag with and a thermos and pops it down on his desk, and all the reporters run screaming out of the room, going filibuster. Well, the so filibusters have a tradition here, and just the other day I listened to Sean Hannity go on and on about how the Democrats just want to change everything. They won't vote for a single one of Bush's appointed judges. They're just opposed to anything that Republicans do. Well, in fact, he's gotten, 208 of his appointments have been done. I mean, it's only been about 10 people that the Democrats have clashed on. It's not every single one, you fucking moron, Sean Hannity. I decided I would pull this up. This is a piece on it's a little piece from PBS on the history of filibusters. Here it comes.
Mayor, expand on that. This began not because the framers decided this was something which should be protected or enshrined in the Constitution necessarily.
Absolutely.
But it was something that became a grand tradition.
And it emerged very slowly and began to be used most particularly with civil rights. The grandest clashes in the history of the filibuster deal with the issue of civil rights, where we had a strong regional opposition to a majority desire to stop things like lynching in the South.
So it was about minority rights.
Absolutely. And it gives these minorities that impassioned chance to say no. Nothing else happens until someone compromises with us.
We should say when we talk about minority rights, we're talking about literally the most, not just some civil rights language, but also the people who have the fewest votes.
Yes. In the history of the filibuster, usually racial minorities are not the winners. The one great exception was sort of a filibuster threat by Carol Moseley Braun in 1993 when they were about to grant recognition to the Daughters of the Confederacy again, and she threatened to filibuster. And one.
How have they been used in the past? What are the most famous? I mentioned Strom Thurmond. I mentioned Huey Long, who apparently opined about pot liquor on the floor of the Senate as a way to take time. How have they been used?
Well, there have been two categories, roughly. One, the serious filibusters, as Jeremy has referenced to, the ones over civil rights, also the ones over slavery in the 19th century. But there's also been a class of what we might call trivial filibusters, right? The two Nebraska senators in the 1980s were filibustering a bill that would have created a radio station to broadcast into Cuba. Why were they opposed? Well, they feared that Cuba would jam the new station and would interfere with the Des Moines radio station, right? Well, that meets my definition of probably a trivial filibuster.
Well, my favorite is Al D'Amato filibustering over 750 jobs in upstate New York with a typewriter factory. He went on for 15 hours and ended up singing songs about Mexico.
Well, now, I remember that. It was really not musical. But let's think back for a moment about the way that these are intended to be used. You say they're supposed to represent minority rights. So we see today a big fight about changing the rules. Have the rules ever been changed before?
Many times. They go back to there used to be no cloture vote at all until 1970. Cloture is when the supermajority can step in and say, stop this debate. It used to be there was no way to stop a single senator. There was just the respect that senator might have for the institution. But in 1917, Wilson pressed to have this limited. And you have, he anticipated perhaps the Treaty of Versailles going through the Senate. And since then, we've changed it now to 60 votes, as Sarah said.
So, Professor Finder, let's talk about that. If they're talking about making this change, this rule change, how significant is that? If we know that there was already a rule change which allowed debate to be cut off, how significant is this rule change as we see it?
Well, the theme to keep in mind here is that technically this nuclear option that's been
which we should explain what that is. That's just reducing the number of votes it would take to cut off filibuster.
Filibuster, but only for a certain type of judicial nomination. What's important, though, is that this would not technically be a change in the formal rules of the Senate, which the other types of changes that Jeremy has referred to. This would be a change in precedent, which are interpretations of the rules, right? How do rules apply in different circumstances? And that's a lot more controversial for the Senate, even for a chamber that rarely changes its rules.
Is there any way, are there other ways which have been used to derail judicial nominees?
Well, judicial nominations have been controversial, at least for the past 25 years, as well as historically we've seen debates over them. When Clinton administration sent up judicial nominations to the Senate, Republicans were in control for 6 of the 8 years. Well, they didn't need to filibuster because they controlled access to the floor. So senators used holds, anonymous holds on nominations to prevent them from coming to the floor. They use blue slips, a committee process which allows the home state senator essentially to derail a nominee, and sometimes they simply didn't hold a hearing. Again, all ways, pretty invisible ways, but nonetheless ways of stopping judicial nominations.
Jeremy Mayer, in this debate that's going on right now, one of the things that the folks who are in favor of the president's judicial nominees have said consistently, in fact on this program many times, which is that this has never been used this way before, that the filibuster has never been used and shouldn't be used to derail a presidential judicial nominee. Is that true?
That's flat out not true. There was the Fortas nomination, but moreover, some of the Republicans who've been saying that actually voted for unsuccessful filibuster attempts against Clinton nominees.
Explain the Abe Fortas nomination. This was a Johnson nomination.
Johnson
for Chief
was
Justice.
Leaving office, and Fortas was being promoted to Chief Justice. Now, a lot of ethical complaints emerged about Fortas, who was also quite liberal and controversial.
He was already on the court.
He was already on the court, and there was a filibuster attempt made, and it was clear that they didn't have the votes, probably even to get a majority for Fortas, so they allowed the nomination to die. They withdrew it. There have been more recent filibuster attempts by Republicans to stop judicial nominations. They just weren't successful. So I think it's we shouldn't give them credit for voting and not succeeding.
But there's a very narrow way of defining what this is and what those were, which makes it a little bit more complicated. It makes it possible for them to make these claims.
Absolutely. I mean, part of the problem is this. We say, we know pornography when we see it, but we don't really know filibusters when we see them. Sometimes it's in the eye of the holder, and there are political reasons to say we are filibustering or we're not filibustering, and it makes it very hard to compare episodes over time.
Now, this term, nuclear option, was actually coined by Senator Trent Lott, a Republican, but and there's some debate over whether that's the right term or not. But in the end, the reason why it was used is because it signals some sort of monumental change in the rules. Would this be a monumental change in the rules?
Well, it would be. It's nuclear.
Destructive,
it's
yeah.
Nuclear in two ways. First of all, the process by which they're trying to ban filibusters, the process is nuclear, the series of procedural events that they anticipate occurring. It has to break with the way the Senate traditionally deals with points of order. But second, it's nuclear in the sense of how we expect Democrats to react, which is, as they said, we will probably blow the place up. Which is to say, just because you ban filibusters of judicial nominations, that leaves wide open a whole range of procedural tactics for individuals and for the minority party in the Senate to exploit. And that could be very detrimental to the majorities and their ability to pursue its agenda.
Another question. The other terminology which has been used in this debate is the Republicans mostly have called this the constitutional option, saying there's constitutional protection for the Senate to be able to change its own rules to do its business. Is there a constitutional basis for that?
Both sides are clinging to the Constitution in this debate. A lot of Democratic-related groups are saying, you know, in ads on the air around the country that the Constitution involved. The Constitution is silent about the filibuster. This does not involve the Constitution. The Senate is given the power under the Constitution to set up its own rules. So both sides in the debate are wrong when they try to wrap themselves in the Constitution.
So what has to happen now? That you're saying you both agree in that case that both of these cases, that the Senate has the right to do what it wants to do with its own rules, but what are the long-term implications that you can see?
Well, the Senate has to figure out how it's going to deal with having supermajority rules that block majorities in an era of intense polarization of the parties. And if they're going to do away with filibusters on judicial nominations, they have to be prepared to have it taken away on all other nominations and all other legislative measures.
For instance, what do you mean?
Well, first, we could easily see if they succeed in banning filibusters of judicial nominations, it could be extended to ban filibusters of executive branch nominations, right, under the reasoning that this is advice and consent. But it could also then be extended, I wouldn't be surprised to see extended to different policy areas, as they've done with budget or trade in the past, or to see it extended broadly to ban the filibuster altogether. And senators have to decide, is that the institution that they want for the future?
Do you see it having that broad an effect, potentially?
I think it could, and I think a lot of people need to realize the filibuster is the most undemocratic element in American politics, except for the Supreme Court itself.
What do you mean?
That the Senate is already undemocratic. We don't do it by population. Small states get equal representation with California.
Well, and that the founding fathers did.
Clearly intended. But now, with the filibuster, 40 senators, representing as small as 16% of the U.S. population, can stop everything. It's one reason we have the agricultural policies we do, which give such huge subsidies to such a small percentage of Americans. It's because the agricultural states, which are largely empty, have a strong voice in the Senate.
Okay. Well, Jeremy Mayer and Sarah Binder, thank you both very much for helping us out.
Actually, I find an awful lot of the news today is just depressing. And so when I do an interview, when I bring somebody into the studio, I kind of want to talk about the things that are positive. This fellow here this morning is, well, for one thing, he's been my boss, so I just have to admit that...
No, I thought you were going to cover that up.
No. How did they say that on the big networks?
Truth in advertising.
Yeah, it's to be honest, so that we know who's here. Now, who's here is one
he's
of the
bucking for a raise, I guess.
One of the he's one of the most generous guys I ever knew. But he's a lot of things. He's a modern Los Angeles Renaissance man, musician, songwriter. Producer with his own label, We Bad Records, photographer, videographer with extensive archives of music, theater, and performance art from the 80s up to the noughties here.
And circuses.
And circuses, the Bindlestiffs.
What are they called? The absurd, Circus Ridiculous.
Circus Ridiculous was there too?
Yeah, I've taped them.
Film producer, writer, Department of Water and Power, electric station operator, all-round general swab guy, commune member, sculptor, entrepreneur,
costume designer,
and philanthropist. Rush Riddle.
And architect.
And architect.
Well, builder, I don't know, carpenter, cabinet maker, tap dancer. And I play the triangle when I was in Green Jello.
Yeah, he was in Green Jello, folks.
You never remember him.
Yeah, but...
It's been 15 years since I was in that band.
But that was theater music, right?
Yeah.
That was very theatrical music staging. And when I came out here to California, what I found was the best theater in L.A. was music, was happening in the music world. That's me. But you're here, you know, you do so many things, but you're a giver, you know?
Yeah.
I've known Rush now 10, 11 years. You throw these massive parties every May Day for the commune.
And it used to be every Halloween, but or every other one. But
I DJ'd one of the Halloween parties. And these massive parties with you have gotten so many bands together in your lounge. Besides recording them, you've brought so many people together so many times. You've already shown the value simply by doing what you normally do, but you do more, you know. And so, I know that you give money to the Girl Scouts, which is one of my favorite things, because the Boy Scouts get so much money. They get like 90% more money than the Girl Scouts.
Oh, I don't know about that. But
well, the Girl Scouts are separate from the Boy Scouts.
Oh yeah.
In the rest of the world, it's just Scouts. It's only in the United States that it's Boy Scouts. And the Girl Scouts are actually a separate organization from the Boy Scouts,
yeah.
And they're not the same group at all. And the Girl Scouts of America don't get as much funding. So I just think it's neat that you give to them. How'd that get started?
Well, for one, I was a Boy Scout. I was very involved in it. I'm very pissed off at the Boy Scouts now because they're very anti-gay. And anti-atheist, of which I am one of the two.
Right.
And I just think it's pretty rotten what they're doing, because basically the Boy Scouts are the only show in town. If you want to have that kind of experience of going camping and learning to whittle and learning, you know, some skills that are actually valuable, first aid, swimming, and animal husbandry and world history and all that kind of stuff. It's a good thing, this scouting program, I think. However, I don't like the organization. So,
It was a political choice.
Yeah, I mean, I was always angry at the Boy Scouts in recent years. Then, I was reading the paper, I think it was the Daily News, long ago, it had to have been at least 10 years ago, I think, now, and they had an article on the Girl Scouts having troops located in homeless shelters, and they were for particularly younger kids, little kids, but they were for, and they were open to the boys also to be involved in it. So any kid, if mom was in a homeless shelter with the kids, the Girl Scouts tried to provide activities for the kids. And I thought that was wonderful because, I mean, sometimes we get into these, you know, homeless shelters or battered women's shelters, and all they're really trying to do is give them a roof over their head and provide some food. So there's more to life than that. And I read this article, and at one point the one of the girls said, "We're hoping to go to Raging Waters this year." And I just thought, gee, you know, every kid should get to go to Raging Waters at least once in their life, yeah. You know. And the other amusement parks that are a little more famous. But Raging Waters is just a certain kind of experience. And I just figured, well, let me see if I can help them achieve that dream. So I called them up and told them that I'd give them like $500. It's been every year I give them $500, which is really not a lot of money when you consider these, you know, millionaires giving $500,000 and or $5 million or $10 million or whatever to a school or their own little project or whatever. But it's just kind of a steady contribution I try to make every year to them. Unfortunately, it's not enough to send the homeless troops to Raging Waters because they need insurance. The insurance to take a carload of kids or a busload, to rent the bus and the driver and get the insurance on it for the day and stuff was and the fees to go to Raging Waters, the whole deal was, I think, gosh, I can't remember. I want to say $3,000, but it wasn't even like it was $1,000. At $1,000, I might have said, "Well, heck, I'll give you $1,000." But actually, what really sealed the deal for me was that year. And it must have been around '94 or '95. I had been thinking about. I had gone to Burning Man for 2 years, and I had been contemplating something that hadn't been done at Burning Man up until that date, which was to purchase one of those Doughboy swimming pools that you can, you know, this freestanding, it's about 5 or 6 feet deep, and you put it in your yard, and it's all reinforced, and it's got a big plastic tarp that holds all the water, and you can splash around in your front yard with nothing more than the Doughboy and the pumps and filters and whatnot, and a garden hose. And that, in those days, that thing was going to cost about $1,500, and I figured, okay, $1,500, we load it in, and we get the water imported from Reno or someplace like that, and who knows how much that would cost. The other problem with water like that, you must have an electrical pump to be running filters, because swimming pool water will get very funky in like 24 hours. Uh-huh. So some people seem to think it's a bathroom, you know. So it seemed like a great idea to overcome, you know, heavy odds and put a swimming pool in the middle of the desert. But I thought about it and thought, well, this is a frivolous thing. And Burning Man is just having, you know, just people, grown-ups that have certain amount of resources and are able to go to a thing like that, just give them an amusement. But whereas I could turn around and not spend that money on that and take it and spend it on the Girl Scouts and maybe change somebody's life, or at least give them one day out of the summer when they could feel like they were just like a normal kid, you know. When once you get your swimming suit on and go to the pool at Raging Waters, you're just right up there with the kids that live in Beverly Hills or whatever.
You yeah. See, this is how Rush thinks. He actually thinks around possibilities, makes decisions, and does something for somebody else. This, I don't know. Not wanting to kiss your ass or anything.
Yeah.
But nonetheless. That story is better than anything I could even imagine,
huh.
Because it's actually, I don't know.
So have you heard that before?
No, you never told me that before.
Yeah, well, that's how it came about. And then I just committed to it. I figured they called me up and told me it wasn't, you know, that it really didn't look like it could happen. Was it still okay to take the money? Would they still would? Was I disappointed or would I do it? And I just said, well, forget it. The Girl Scouts do not discriminate against atheists, nor do they discriminate against gays.
They don't even discriminate against boys, like the
right.
When Gloria Allred makes a statement like the Girl Scouts should be able to join the Scouts, the Boy Scouts, and she's ridiculed. Mm-hmm. The Girl Scouts except boys.
I don't know that they do in the upper ages. I'm not sure, but the only thing I do know, because I'm not too involved in the organization, but. I do know that in the homeless shelters they would permit the boys to be involved in the activities. I'm not sure that they were joining or making them members, and obviously there's no boys' Girl Scout uniforms.
Right.
But it's more an idea of hey, we're here to provide some entertainment and amusement and, you know, a little different thing than you're used to getting. There's some divergence from your normal funky routine of being homeless and a child, you know.
Now, you used to be like me. You used to have periods where you didn't have a lot of money, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it took time. It took time to put things
in. Well, I stumbled into a good paying job, and I stuck with it.
Hey, 20 years ago, I was making $30,000, $40,000 a year, so I wasn't doing too bad.
Right.
You know, things happen. But, you know, so... When you started making money through your work with the DWP and some of the other things you do, was it just automatic that you looked for stuff like this?
Well, I always felt that, I mean, I've lived communally now for 36 years, and there were times when it wouldn't necessarily be communal people, but maybe other people, particularly when I was at school at USC, I'd be like, well... Okay, we're going to go to Palm Springs for the weekend. You want to go? The room will cost this much money and that, and you got, you know. And it's like, no, you guys go ahead, whatever. You know, or hey, we're going out to eat at Spago's tonight. You want to go? And it's like, you know, I don't have any money. I can't really go to those things. And they would go ahead and go. And it was just kind of a painful thing to me. It's like, I felt if I was involved in a group of people, you know, 4 or 5 or 10 or whatever, and we wanted to do something and somebody else couldn't do it because they didn't have enough money, well, either we don't go or we pay for that person. I don't want to, you know, go have fun and know that there are people that didn't join me because they couldn't afford it, but that I, you know, to me the people are more important than the fun. So, you know, we can sit at home and sit on the porch and get our guitars out and play music and have just as much fun as if we had gone to Palm Springs. So, I'm more dedicated to the people than I am to fun. I mean, I can't just have, you know, an extravagant time knowing there's somebody in my house that's hungry.
pulled in just behind the fridge. He lays her down, he frowns. Gee, my life's a funny thing. Am I still too young? He kissed the van on there. She took his ring, took his babies. It took him minutes, took her nowhere. Heaven knows he'd have taken anything.
All night.
She was a young American. She finds a slinky vagabond. He calls as he passes a Ford Mustang. But heaven forbid she take anything. But the freak and his title for nothing. This is a step and cuts his hand. Showing nothing, it swoops like a song. She cries, where are all Papa's heroes gone?
All night.
She wants a young American. Her breadwinner begs off the bathroom floor. We live for just these 20 years. Do we have to die for the 50 more?
All night.
He wants a young
American. Young
American.
Young American. He wants a young American.
All right. He wants a young American. President Nixon, do you remember the bills you have to pay, or even yesterday? Have you been on America, just you and your idle civil settled out? Not a myth left from the ghetto. Well, would you carry a pizza? Just in case of depression. Sit on your hands on the bus of survivors, blushing at all the Afro-sealers. Ain't that close to love? Well, ain't that close to love? Well, it ain't that far before. Her heart's been broken just like you and the young America.
David Bowie and Young Americans. Yeah. As long as everybody's got enough to eat. What's interesting about all this from the past to the present is to see that you've formulated in this time period, in this 30, 40 year tumultuous time period, and
God,
I'm back again to saying that you do good things.
Well, thanks.
You know? Yeah. Are there any other charities that you give to?
Yeah, sure. Another thing I'm involved in is the Dance of Tennis. It's a... They bring tennis to at-risk youth in the inner city. Kids that don't have the opportunity. My friend Yana Markovici, Dr. Yana Markovici, is ahead of it. It's called the Dance of Tennis. The idea is to bring non-competitive tennis to the kids. And he has 5 cities nationwide. Every spring he goes out and spends a week, I think, in each one of these: Boston, San Francisco, Los Angeles, Miami, and one more somewhere, I'm not sure. Or maybe more. He's expanding every year. He comes out, he trains, teachers to teach this method. He gets it in the schools. They in Los Angeles here, they work with the
I know you even provide the sound system for the event
the
in Los Angeles.
I do, yeah, he has music that they like to play a lot of reggae and pop music and stuff like that while the kids are playing tennis, which really brings kids in. You know, they like to hear music, and I've got a PA system that he borrows every year, and you know, that's one way to help out with that.
Well, I think we've covered the general bases that I wanted to talk about here. Anything else you'd like to say this morning?
Yeah, nobody's free till we're all free.
Yeah. So. Thank you, Rush Riddle.
Okay.
We do appreciate this.
25 cents.
It's in my pocket.
Oh, yeah.
All right.
I don't work free anymore.
And Rush will be back because the film Average Man will be finished sometime, and we're going to have an on-air discussion about with the director, the writer, and the star in the future. This is...
Yeah, I'll be appearing at my house nightly, so come down and check me out.
That's Ellis Island Commune, longest-standing commune in Los Angeles. Thank you, Rush, and this has been it for Kill Radio.
Okay, so, caller, your question about the Hubble telescope was what again?
Well, basically, what's the future of Hubble as far as funding and the future of the project?
This is right up your alley, because we've talked about this. This is one of your favorite NASA projects.
Oh, yeah,
Hubble, right?
and it should be everybody's. I mean, the Hubble has delivered way back when it went up, and I was wrong, actually, at the beginning, because I said we're going to get a discovery a day, and then we had the problem with the mirror that was figured incorrectly, and so we had a delay, and then we got a discovery a day. In fact, more than a discovery a day. This telescope has got to be regarded as one of the most important instruments that we have ever developed for astronomy. And as a result, we've seen things and learned things that we never even had inklings of before, and confirmed stuff that we wanted to know. But the future of it is, in fact, not very good at the moment, because there is no funding in place at this time for the repair mission that would bring the instrument up to the next sort of generation of its operation, the next several years of operation. And because of that, things will go wrong on it. It's a machine, and things go wrong. If it were on the ground, same thing would happen. But if we're not doing maintenance on it because we can't go up there in the shuttle, well, then it's just going to die the slow death. The instrument is, in fact, a fairly sophisticated telescope. Now, it's had four repair missions, and so it's not an old telescope. It's actually a pretty new telescope, but it's subject to all the stresses of being in space, and if it doesn't get attention, tender, loving care, it's going to just quit working on us.
Where in space, and I know this is one of those questions that you look at me like, "What? You're a complete idiot," but where in space is it?
Oh, it's up several hundred miles up above the Earth's surface, and just going around, and it follows an orbit that shifts, you know, from orbit to orbit a little bit, but it's, you know...
Further out than the International Space Station?
Yeah. I mean, you saw me, you know, reaching for the answer there, but the answer is yes.
And a quarter of the way to the moon? Is it?
No. It's farther. It's not that much farther. It's close to the Earth compared to anything else. It's in Earth orbit and fairly nearby. The James Webb telescope, which is said to going to be to replace it, although that telescope is actually quite different in terms of the kind of light that it catches. But that one would be way out from the Earth, and that one you couldn't go up and just do a repair mission as you can by reaching it with the shuttle.
Why did they put it so far out?
Oh, you know, I know the answer, you know, just off the cuff to say it had to be there. It probably has to be there in order to be in an orbit that is stable enough. It's not going to degrade because of the variations in the Earth's atmosphere slowing the thing down. In fact, its orbit has been altered a bit from time to time, depending.
If we could ideally place an object somewhere in our solar system that would have the best vantage point, would it be between, say, you know, Mars and Earth? Would it be between Pluto and, I mean, where would it be, or does does that not really matter?
Well, it matters to a degree. I mean, I think that if astronomers had their druthers, they'd say, let's put it on some solid ground, for one thing, because that's easier if you can get to some other solid ground. Get it off the Earth, though.
A planet with no atmosphere?
That'd be good. And we've got one that's, you know, fairly close by. It's not a planet. It's a moon, and it's the moon.
Titan?
Our moon.
Oh, our moon.
Our moon's a very good place. You put it on the side of the moon that faces away from the Earth, and therefore most of the interference.
See, now that seems like a pretty... If we can land stuff on Mars, why couldn't we get something to our moon?
Oh, we can do it. It just costs money.
But why hasn't that been a priority over more skateboards on Mars?
Now, Mr. KABC, this is, in fact... another one of your profound questions, because there's all kinds of things that we want to know, and skateboards on Mars is actually probably not as hard to do,
really,
and not as expensive to do as building an observatory, because that's what it would take to make it worthwhile, a large scale observatory on the backside of the moon. Remember, we had Saturn V rockets to take people to the moon. We don't have to send people to Mars to make the skateboards work, and so it's a much less expensive endeavor.
Mm. All right, we'll continue with Dr. Krupp and your phone calls.
That's Fred Krupp from the Griffith Observatory, and one more segment on astronomy.
And, you know, the best one, I mean, this is good that we can plan ahead, because we got July coming, it's May, and we need a little time to plan. But the 4th of July, you know, NASA is just perfect. You know, it's always hitting something on the 4th of July for fireworks for us. And this time, you know, we're sending a spacecraft, smacking it into a comet. This was the Revenge of the Dinosaurs mission, you know.
So deep impact, this
deep
is
impact
what this is called.
Right, yeah. So this is cool. And, you know, for the longest time, there was no camera going to be included with this mission, because, like, it's heavy. You know, you got to add a camera to the spacecraft, and they're always concerned about weight. But finally, somebody figured, you mean you're going to smash something into a comet, and you're not going to see what it looks like? This is not smart. So they added a camera, and we'll get to see it.
And they send that, and it's also not just the camera, but the telemetry to send all that information back, and that adds weight and cost. And this has been planned for how long?
Gosh, suddenly I'm gone cold. I don't even know how long.
But like a long time, years,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah. Well, any of these missions take that long to plan. You can't build a spacecraft fast. These are like one of a kind. These are the great jewels of our era. You know, the great monuments of our time. They're gorgeous in their craftsmanship and their intricacy, and of course the way they work.
This is not going to be one of those things because someone built it partly in metric and someone built it in English, and that we're going to miss the comet entirely or something. That's not going to happen.
Well, you never know, right?
But that's supposed to happen on the 4th of July.
Yeah.
Okay, and then when, before or after in July, are we going to have a space shuttle
launch?
Now,
my memory is that is later in the month. I think it's around mid-month that launch has been moved. But maybe one of the listeners got a better angle on it than I remember right
and
now.
And that's been, what, over 2 years since the last space shuttle catastrophe, and we're down to, what, 3 shuttles left? 4? How many do we have?
No, I want to...
Workable shuttles? This really isn't your area of expertise.
No, but I'm trying to think. I should know this. And 3 even sounds uncomfortable to me, but we lost 2.
Now, if this goes without a hitch, we could see another launch in, what, 60 days after that? Is that possible?
Yeah, you know, it's possible, but I think what you're going to see is also, 2 pressures. One is there's a lot of backlog in important things to be doing with the shuttle. At the same time, there is a renewed sense of caution, and you're going to see a very careful review of everything, but it will be encouraging if it goes right, of course.
The skateboards on Mars, how are those performing?
The last I saw was that report, it was like my car, it was stuck in a sand dune.
But it performed way longer than they thought it was going to.
They're far, far past
Life expectancy. Yeah.
And, in fact, the solar panels and the batteries that are involved there kind of did a reversal that was a little mystifying, where they were going down and people were expecting things to just sort of fizzle out, and then everything picked up again, at least on one of them. But the discoveries that these things have made, are turning Mars, like our other spacecraft, but these more than ever, into a real place. I mean, here we are driving around and seeing the landscape. It's like being on vacation.
But there was an initial period where every night on the news there were these spectacular finds and weird rocks with funny name, cartoon names, and then it just all stopped. And so I figured, okay, well, these things they've outlived their 60-day life cycle, and that's the batteries are dead, and they're done. And someone called me and said, hey, what's happening with those? And I said, they're dead. And the caller goes, no, they're not. They're still functioning and doing great
In fact, they're even more remarkable than that first intense period because they went to more interesting places. We now have images of like vistas, you know, where they went up to the rim of a crater, and so you're looking over the crater, into the crater, out beyond the crater, and the distance beyond is the rim of an even bigger crater. And so this is a very interesting landscape that for what we thought was relatively flat land. It's pretty interesting.
Now, we found water, and we found traces of, we found frozen water on Mars, and we found, but that wasn't done with these skateboards.
Right, that was known from other instruments, right?
And then we had evidence of rivers, so flowing water at some point on Mars, but that's really it. We haven't found any evidence of anything that would even resemble life.
No evidence of anything resembling life, but the big deal here with these spacecraft was that they found very specific evidence of standing water, essentially deep water, water that allowed sedimentation to occur. And so what you're fundamentally talking about is seas or lakes or something of a large scale. And it's that kind of a body of water that we associate with the possible conditions for life. So it tells us that Mars was warm enough to have liquid water on the surface for a period of time, and that, of course, parallels the situation on Earth.
And can geologists determine how long ago that was based on rock formations?
Yeah, they can make estimates, and this kind of analysis is going on, and there are you know, arguments and uncertainties about it. So we are really just at the beginning of understanding this history of the behavior of Mars. In fact, we did not even have the evidence that this water stood essentially in fairly deep bodies of it until these spacecraft. So this is not a story that's told yet.
A week ago Monday, there was a story about a gamma ray burst.
Yeah.
And this is like this guys like you went. This was like Christmas for guys like you because it was what is perhaps the birth of a black hole that had been witnessed.
Yeah, these gamma ray bursts. You know, it sounds very exotic. You know, you think like the Incredible Hulk. You know, being made out of gamma rays or something. But. These gamma ray bursts are very, very brief events that let out a tremendous amount of energy. And we're lucky to even see them at all. And people have been seeing these for decades, you know, with instruments that are up above the atmosphere. And so the big question is, well, what could possibly be letting this stuff explode like this? How could you get all this energy out of something? And so where were they? Nobody even knew how far away they are, what causes it. And theories were put together to possibly explain this. Well, the big thing about this particular event was that this is the first time that an instrument that was designed to catch the thing right away, to, you know, suddenly swivel around, thing was called SWIFT, turn and catch it just as the thing's going off and establish where it is and then make other observations to figure out what that object is. And the observations seem to suggest what we've got here are two highly condensed stars that crash into each other. They're orbiting around each other, neutron stars, although even more highly magnetic than most neutron stars are, and when they crash into each other, the annihilation of matter is what produces all of this energy and produces the black hole in the collision.
And is there a black hole now where those two stars collided?
If this explanation is correct, yep, that's the case.
And what do you see when you look through a telescope at this point in space where these two stars collided?
Actually, with a telescope, you can't really see much of anything. I mean, you certainly don't see the black hole as a hole in the sky or anything like that. What we've really got there is the behavior of the gamma rays to tell us how that they were formed. When we get a fast enough observation of this, and then we can get an idea of where in the sky it's located, but we don't have an image of this object.
And was I right that Stephen Hawking is the theorist that came up with the idea of the black hole, or does it predate him?
Well, no, in fact, black holes, in a sense, are really a part of old...
Let's leave our discussion now of outer space. It's the end of the Impressionistic News Hour from Kill Radio for Thursday, May 19th, 2005, from 6 to 7 p.m. on killradio.org, and then repeated on Saturday on Upstart Radio. Thanks a lot, guys. Congratulations on the prize. They received an award for best political website from Live 365. So Upstart Radio is part of the Thursday News Hour, too. And it'll be on Radio for All. And when the Kill Radio Archive gets up, it'll be on there. So we've gone into outer space, and we've to see what the potential for the future is. And And we've looked down here on Earth at what one man can do. And meanwhile, the Republicans and the Democrats are fighting over filibusters. And Mina Suvari filed for divorce from her husband Robert last Thursday, the 12th. So just things are changing, right? Anyway, this has been the Thursday Impressionistic News. Hold on. There'll be something else in just a moment. This is killradio.org in Los Angeles. Thanks for listening. Don't forget to kill your friends.